So if you have any nasty comments, just remember I have a sharpened stick. So I have the very difficult and interesting task of trying to bring together to a very sophisticated audience some of the clinical, experimental, and theoretical pieces with regard to ventricular arrhythmias. And I'm going to really focus on, clearly we can't, you know, I couldn't possibly cover all aspects of ventricular arrhythmias, but I hope to at least highlight a few things that I thought could bring in some sense of relevance and connection between some of the things that were talked about at this meeting. First of all, you know, we're all aware of the magnitude of the problem. I'm not sure that people have seen the figures related to sudden death laid out in this way, but when you look at the overall incidence of sudden cardiac death, sudden cardiac arrest in that case, it's not only highly substantial from a public health point of view, but it's much larger in scope than stroke, lung cancer, breast cancer, and AIDS put together. So this is a huge public health problem. Because the problem is you have Elizabeth Taylor promoting these things, and we have people like us promoting these things. Okay. So Elizabeth Taylor wins every time.
Try theoretical kinetics matter physics. It's worse.
So what I'd like to start very broadly. And how do we approach this problem? You know, we're all in this field, one way or another, to try to promote public health. And how can we do this? Well, you know, one way you can do this is you can have a sophisticated rescue squad. We happen to have the largest one in the West at our place, but it doesn't matter where you go. We have 4 helicopters, Lear jets, sophisticated paramedic rescue squads. Educated public with regard to CPR, and this has been done in numerous communities. And here, this gentleman here, I don't think he cares what type of VF he had. He had a cardiac arrest and was resuscitated. And a great deal of effort goes into this, but unfortunately, it's dismally ineffective. The overall success rate of successfully resuscitating somebody who has out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is 5% or less. If you're in a big city, New York, Los Angeles, forget about it. It's about 3%. If you're in a medium-sized city, it's somewhat better. The worst place to be is Wisconsin. I don't know why. out-of-hospital arrest survivor rate is lowest, maybe because of all the cheese. I don't know. But this hasn't been a very effective approach to this problem. And you know, now there's more recently a move to use automatic external defibrillators. You see them all over the place, and that may have somewhat of an impact, but probably not a major impact. So rescuing people once they've had an arrest is probably too late. So let's look at the other side. How can we prevent ventricular arrhythmias from starting in the first place? Well, how about drugs? Drugs are used in medicine all the time. This slide summarizes some of the trials that have attempted to test the hypothesis that you can use a drug to prevent, to prophylax, if you will, against sudden cardiac death. And a number of different antiarrhythmic drugs have been tried, class 1A, class 1C in the CAST trial, so on and so forth. I'd just like to make 3 points. One point is, if you look at the, this is a relative risk, so that means anything on to the right, anything to the right of this line means there was some detrimental effect. Anything to the left of this line means there was some beneficial effect of the drug. And when you see more or less, all the drugs with their errors line up right around that line. So it's more or less a wash, with 2 notable exceptions. If you give a patient an antiarrhythmic drug, like Sotalol, like class 1C drug, Flecainide, propafenone, and so on, not only does the drug fail to reduce mortality, reduce sudden death, it actually provokes sudden death. And this was a very sobering piece of information that was discovered in this field a number of years ago. And Arcadius.
Can I ask a question? How these drugs, let's say, that are so bad, how were they, why it was decided that they are bad?
Well, yeah, there's a whole story behind that. Most of the drugs were not designed, not developed for the purpose of antiarrhythmic activity. Okay, most of them were developed
You're
for other reasons.
You. You don't have to.
Oh, you want me to? Sorry. So most of the drugs were designed for other purposes, and so blocking sarcolemmal ion channels does not seem to be the trick. The other thing I'd like to point out, because there was some, I think Bob and some others mentioned something about the autonomic nervous system. The only drugs that seem to prevent sudden death are drugs that block beta adrenergic receptors. And actually, although this has been known for quite some time, it's only recently been very well accepted and implemented in clinical practice. So this problem with the so-called proarrhythmia from drugs has really had a major impact on the pharmaceutical industry. This has really paralyzed drug development, not only from the standpoint of antiarrhythmic drugs, but from all drugs. Any drug company that wants to develop a drug has to do extensive testing for IKR activity, for example, to make sure it's not going to be proarrhythmic. So drugs aren't very promising. Rescue squads aren't very promising. What about defibrillators? Defibrillators are a very effective means of, these are implantable defibrillators, okay, like our vice president has, are very effective means of aborting an episode of sudden death. It doesn't prevent the initiation of ventricular fibrillation, but they very effectively terminate VF. A number of trials have been performed, clinical trials, to establish the utility of implanting a defibrillator in someone prophylactically, that is, giving someone hardware before they actually have a life-threatening event. There's not enough time to go through all the studies, but one of the more recent ones, the MATA 2 trial, basically said you take patients without really much risk stratification, just patients with a reduced ejection fraction, reduced contractile function with an EF below 30%, and coronary disease. And it showed, demonstrated a relatively significant but modest benefit, about a 5.5% reduction in risk in 2 years. So you reduce mortality by 5.5% with this approach. For the patients who were saved, that's, you know, 100% for each patient. But overall, it's a relatively modest improvement, because it's really a needle in a haystack kind of approach. You're saying take all patients with sick hearts, let's implant defibrillators and see how they do. So it's not terribly sophisticated. And at the end of the day, if you practice this type of medicine, you'd have to implant 17 defibrillators to save one life. Okay, so it's not terribly efficient. It's very effective, and there's considerable cost considerations involved.
But in the last,
Before?
Next.
Oh, next.
Read the last line, and here 144.
Oh, yeah, this is another trial that used risk stratification, used risk stratification. So instead of just implanting defibrillators in anybody with a sick heart,
you chose to whom to implant.
They implanted based on having a positive electrophysiology study. So if you were able to put catheters in the heart and induce ventricular tachycardia, then put a defibrillator in, so it's much more selective. Then you implant 4 defibrillators to save one life. So it's no surprise you're looking at a much more selective audience. Okay. Well, these are people, ideally, you know, this all has to be viewed in the context of the populations that were recruited, but ideally, the people you target for primary prevention are functional, active, working, tax-paying, you know, citizens, and you wouldn't want to apply this approach to someone who has, you know, multi-system organ failure or, you know, and is otherwise not expected to, you know, live a reasonably normal life. Well, the success rate of defibrillators in defibrillating the heart is very high. That's not an issue. The technology is very effective. The problem is who you decide needs a defibrillator. That's the difficulty.
One more question. Mm-hmm. The last one from 17.
it means that 16 implantable defibrillators, they never fired.
Right.
They were implanted, but they
never the people never use it. And it's not, it wouldn't be considered clinically unacceptable to implant defibrillators in people who don't use them. Because if every patient I implant a defibrillator in gets VF, that means I'm not implanting enough defibrillators. I'm letting some people go out who are having VF unprotected without a device. So there's a certain accepted ratio, which hasn't been fully defined yet, of number of devices you can implant for everyone who uses it. But you'd like that to be as low as possible, you know, ideally. Yes, had was resuscitated from a shock. Would have died without it. Right. Yeah, would have most likely died without a device. Okay. So this is the current state of the art in 2 minutes. From the MATA 2 trial, there was a mysterious subgroup of patients who these are people who all had a low ejection fraction, but there was a group that had a prolongation of their QRS duration that showed a somewhat elevated risk, where a defibrillator offered more protection compared to patients who had a narrow QRS. Okay, and based on this, the organization that decides how to reimburse for defibrillators made what a lot of us consider a somewhat arbitrary decision, because it was based on a sub-study analysis like this, made an arbitrary decision that in this country, defibrillators are only going to be paid for under these circumstances for prophylaxis if someone not only has an ejection fraction below 30 and coronary disease, but has a prolonged QRS interval on their ECG of greater than 120 milliseconds. And that's what we're dealing with right now. Okay, so that's where we are. And why have we failed really to this point in controlling sudden death? Well, the problem is, I think, summarized schematically here. This iceberg represents the 400,000 Americans who'll have sudden death. If you've had a cardiac arrest, it's obvious that you need a defibrillator, no problem. The real problem, though, is the vast majority of individuals who are going to go on and develop cardiac arrest may have some risk factors for heart disease, may have no known heart disease at all, and they're lurking beneath the surface of the water out of clinical view, and they're missed. They're missed, and they present for the first time with a life-threatening arrhythmia. So how do we identify the high-risk individual? Well, there's a lot of things we don't know in this field, but one thing we know for sure is that reduced contractile function is a very strong predictor of arrhythmic events. These are old data, but they're very relevant for the multicenter post-infarction research group, which followed patients after they had heart attack and looked at cardiac events. And what it basically found is that the lower the left ventricular ejection fraction is, the worse the contractility, the greater the risk of cardiac events. And this seemed to really asymptote up when you had EFs below 30%. And this is why most clinical trials use ejection fractions of 30 or 35% as a cutoff. It's based on data like this to select high-risk groups. So this begs the question, what is it about left ventricular dysfunction that changes the electrophysiology of the heart that enhances susceptibility to arrhythmias? Because this relationship is undisputable.
Is that visible from the cardiogram, the ejection fraction, or how do you measure it?
Right here. So, perfect setup question. So this is an example of a cross-section taken from a dog heart in a model that we and many other groups have been using of pacing-induced cardiomyopathy. Now, this is not during pacing. This is during sinus rhythm. And when you look at the cross-section, you see the papillary muscles here. So this is kind of going just above the level of below the level of the mitral valve. So here's the anterior wall, the posterior wall, the septum of the heart here. And you can see a normal heart at baseline has a very nice symmetrical contraction. The wall thickens during each contraction. And you don't have to be an echocardiographer, which I'm certainly not, to recognize that with the progression of heart failure, you get a progressive diminution of contractile function, where here you get to a very severe advanced stage where you would say that, you know, the ejection fraction here is probably about, you know, 5% or so, very, very low. And so this is what happens to patients, and a major question then is, what is happening to the electrophysiology of the heart in response to this clear structural remodeling that takes place that seems to lead to arrhythmias. Well, this produces the clinical syndrome of heart failure, which is where you have diminished exercise capacity, you get shorter breath, diminished activity, and basically less tolerance for activity. It could progress to the point where one is bedridden. And you may have heard of there's a New York Heart Association classification for heart failure. That, you know, so class 4 heart failure is if you're bedridden, class 1 if you're normal, you know, class 2 if you get short of breath with moderate activity. And so there are clinical classifications for the degree of impairment from heart failure. So what's going on in the heart when this process is happening? Well, let me preface all this by saying that this is real. It's what the changes that occur in heart failure are very complicated, and I'm not going to even attempt to cover all the changes, all the electrophysiological changes that have been reported. But I'm going to try to highlight a couple of those that I think have been consistent findings in the literature, and have been consistently demonstrated, irrespective of the models that have been used or the species that have been employed. So what happens? Well, one of the key things that happened, this is from the Hopkins group, showing an action potential from the dog, and you can get the same thing in human heart failure as well, in the failing versus normal heart. And you see, first of all, there's a marked prolongation of the action potential duration in the failing heart as compared to the...
A short question, is the heart rate going down? Human heart failure, does it slow down?
No.
So this is roughly the same.
Well, no, this is an artificial situation. It's an impaled myocyte, and you know that's being paced. You know, but in real life, if anything, heart rate may go up a little bit with as heart failure because you get
isolated. Yeah.
Well, I'll show you that. That's actually where we're going. Yeah. Now, a couple things. It's late stage, and it's a huge prolongation, more so than what you'll probably see in an intact multicellular heart, more than what you see on the QT interval in a patient. There is QT interval prolongation, but not to this degree. Probably, again, because this recording is being made in the absence of any electrotonic influence in the isolated myocyte, so it's free to express its underlying ion channels. Yes?
What's the failure model?
This is pacing-induced heart failure. But this finding is, what I'm going to show you has been, after sifting through the literature, these are things that are fairly consistent in most models that you see. So number one, heart failure is a disease of repolarization. It affects cardiac repolarization. Number two is shown on the bottom. This is an intracellular calcium transient. So you see in a normal case, you have a brisk cytosolic calcium release that just follows the onset of the action potential through the calcium-induced calcium release mechanism. And there's an equally brisk reuptake of calcium in order to maintain homeostasis. And in heart failure, calcium cycling is markedly disrupted. You see, you get this little wimpy release following the upstroke of the action potential, and then the reuptake of calcium is markedly delayed. So heart failure, secondly, is characterized by markedly altered calcium cycling within the myocyte.
You may have heart failure and no ischemic.
Yeah, let me just make sure I'm clear. The ischemic heart disease is the most common cause of heart failure in this country, okay? But it doesn't mean that you're having active ischemia at the time these recordings were made or in vivo, okay? So this, in other words, there was ischemic damage done in the past, and this is then the heart remodels and dilates. And this is the consequence. This is after the blast. This is the consequences of that damage. Okay, the third thing and the final thing I'm going to mention about heart failure has to do with the disruption of the cellular architecture. These are data, and there's lots of data in the literature on this. These are data I took from Nick Peters' work showing this is a surviving layer of a myocardial infarction of a dog. And just to point out that you see this marked deposition of collagen of fibrous tissue that interdigitates between the myofibrils, shown here. These should normally be laid down in nice, densely packed muscle bundles. So there's a marked disruption, this invagination of the myocardial architecture. And, you know, for people doing simulations and so on, You know, this is you know, one of these things that we really have to take into account. The other thing that happens is this is an immunofluorescent stain of connexin 43, which is the principal protein for gap junctions that form in the ventricle of mammals. And these should normally be aligned in nice parallel bundles at the ends of myocytes. And you see, roughly speaking, there's marked disarray, disorganization of these gap junctions. So you have what has been referred to as a remodeling of cardiac gap junctions, the structural elements that are responsible for electrical communication of one cell to its neighboring cell are markedly disrupted. And then on top of that, the extracellular matrix is markedly disrupted. Bottom line is you expect to see major changes in intercellular coupling and intercellular communication in heart failure. Okay? So calcium repolarization and cell-to-cell coupling. So what causes arrhythmias then? I'm going to just show a model that I'm sure all of you have seen already, but just to emphasize that, you know, many things are responsible for reentry. Reentry is the principal and most important mechanism of arrhythmias. Almost any important clinical arrhythmia is in some way associated with reentry. And although a number of factors are responsible for reentry, one universal and consistent finding is the need for the development of unidirectional block. Okay, in physiological circumstances where, you know, you don't have cross-field stimulation and you're not shocking T waves and you're not struck by lightning, in a physiological situation where you develop a reentrant arrhythmia, you must have unidirectional block. And so this is a very simple schematic diagram showing two fibers, one that has enhanced refractoriness and one that has normal refractoriness. So an impulse propagates down, it blocks in the limb of high refractory properties. So you get unidirectional block, it conducts preferentially down the normal pathway, and then after some suitable conduction delay, this area regains excitability, and then you're off to the races and you have reentrant excitation. So key to this forming is some inhomogeneity between this limb, shown by the stippled region, and this limb. Now this is nice in models, and we're really good at understanding this in certain types of arrhythmias like Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome and macro reentrant rhythms. But there's a far more primitive understanding of how these inhomogeneities are actually formed for ventricular arrhythmias. And this is a conference on ventricular arrhythmias. Let's talk for a moment about the inhomogeneities that are present in the heart. Under normal circumstances, if you look at action potentials recorded through the conduction system, through the ventricle and so on, there's a host of inhomogeneities in the morphology of action potentials that are result from the various distribution of ion channels that are present in the heart. And these normally have a very important and useful function. For example, sinus node cells have intrinsic pacemaker activity, this phase 4 depolarization. That comes in really handy to pace the heart. And there are other specialized conduction systems that are designed to transmit impulses very rapidly. And so these are physiologically and very useful. More recently, attention has been called to changes in heterogeneities that are present even within the ventricle. And these are thought to be very important for the underlying mechanisms of several ventricular arrhythmias. And I'd like to just focus a little time on this. Most of this work was, as you know, promoted by Charlie and Zelovich, where they found in isolated myocytes, if you look at the left ventricular free wall, for example, you see actually a very rich diversity of ion channel composition that spans the ventricular wall from the epicardium to the endocardium. For example, the epicardial cell is characterized by this steep notch and a plateau, a dome. This notch is essentially the action potential signature of the transient outward current that's present in the epicardium, but not in the endocardium. The endocardium doesn't have this notch and dome. And has a different configuration to the action potential. Of interest, you have this sort of intermediate cell, the mid-myocardial cell, or M cell, which has some ITO, but is mainly characterized by not only a stronger sodium current, but a prolonged action potential relative to their endocardial or epicardial neighbors. The prolongation of the M cell is thought to be due to the relative paucity of IKS current that's absent in M cells compared to their epicardial endocardial layers. So you have a weaker outward current, and therefore you have a more prolonged action potential. Also, because you have a weak IKS, you have a cell that's very susceptible to IKR blockade, because these cells are highly dependent on IKR, more so than their neighbors, for repolarization. So if you give a drug that blocks the hERG channel, you're going to have more of an effect on M cells.
This was all healthy.
Yes, this is normal physiology.
Is it believed that there's a kind of a smooth interpolation as you go from one to the other?
Well, actually, I'll focus on that in just a moment. Okay. So the other factor to take into account now is you have different cell types that span the wall that each have their own intrinsic ion properties, but these cells are connected and they electrotonically influence one another, as this simulation from Yoram's group shows, that they introduced a very simple transmural heterogeneity. They said you have endocardial cells that have action potentials that are this short, epicardial cells that are somewhat shorter, mid-myocardial cells that if you study them in isolation, they would have action potentials that are this long. And what happens if we connect them all together? And when you connect them together, the greater the degree of intercellular coupling is shown by this family of curves, the more homogeneity that forms. So coupling homogenizes repolarization. There's a rather minimal gradient of action potential duration from endo to epi when you have a high degree of coupling. When you have relative uncoupling, this model predicts that you'll have a rather steep heterogeneity, a marked gradient of repolarization. And so this caused a lot of people to challenge whether the intrinsic ion channel differences that are present in the heart really are significant. When you put all these cells together and put them in a heart, does it really promote significant heterogeneities that are of any concern whatsoever?
So my question was about really the blue. You're saying that even if the blue, these blue lines are straight, you showed only the extremes.
Right.
One point of each. And then you just modeled it as straight, straight, and straight. And you're saying even if they are
perfectly discrete. Right. The coupling essentially smooths this out, yes.
Right. But then if you actually measure all along rather than just the three points, the blue thing might itself be smooth, no?
No, the blue represents the intrinsic, if you took the myocyte out of the heart.
I understand, but you only... Are there really three bands?
Yeah, this model says very simply.
I know the model, but I'm asking in
yeah. Well, let me get to that. Yeah, that's where I'm going. Yeah, because the prediction made by this model turns out to be partially correct, but partially incorrect, and that's because the assumptions that you're pointing to were incorrect. Okay, so everything I've mentioned at this point has dealt with normal physiology. And so this begs the question, what's the mechanism for pathophysiological heterogeneities in the heart? And as I alluded to, you can have spatial inhomogeneities in expression or function of ion channels. You could have impaired intracellular coupling between cells. And finally, alternance is another mechanism for amplifying heterogeneities. And I'm going to try to, if we have time, I'm going to try to make the case that we believe this is from actually an inhomogeneity in calcium cycling proteins across the heart that gets amplified in certain disease states. So Jack did a great job in setting up optical mapping, so I'm not going to go into this in detail, except to say that we use the for these studies, the isolated arterially perfused canine wedge preparation, where you could take a wedge of myocardium from the free wall or anterior wall of the dog ventricle. You cut it open, you can perfuse it, and it gives you exposure, gives you access to the transmural surface. This wedge is put in a special imaging chamber where we can image the transmural surface using optical mapping. There's all kind of tricks you can do. We sometimes use a prism that's mounted underneath the preparation, so it sits on top of the prism that gives us access simultaneously to the endocardial surface as well. So you can do simultaneous mapping of two sides, and because it's an optical recording, you can bend light and it's not a problem. And when you give these preparations, you make certain disease models. In this case, we made the LQT2 model by giving the preparation sotalol. You perfuse with sotalol, which blocks IKR, and to simulate the herd mutation. And when you do program stimulation with a single extra stimulus, you see an S2 here, you induce this polymorphic ventricular tachycardia that actually has many of the characteristics of Torsades-Dupont in humans. It's not completely similar, but it's bradycardia dependent. It's always associated with long QT interval, long short sequences, very easily induce this. But with single extra stimuli, the induction rate is about 70%. And importantly, in a control wedge, we never induce arrhythmias, ever, with a single extra stimulus. So it's a nice arrhythmia model, because you can discriminate. Oh, I'm sorry, it's bradycardia, slowing the heart rate. So bradycardia, Sotalol, and bradycardia. So it's dependent on both slowing the heart, so that this is done at a... just by pacing, just pacing the heart at a very slow cycle length, 1,000 milliseconds. So the optical mapping, transmural mapping, has been very instructive for revealing the behavior of all the cell types across the wall of the ventricle and seeing how the cell types interact with one another. And this is an example of a normal heart looking from the epicardium to the endocardium. You see a lot of things that you might expect. The epicardial potentials have the shortest duration across the transmural wall. They're also characterized by, there's a little bit of a notch here. Usually we see somewhat of a bigger notch and a dome here, which you don't see in the endocardial surface. Mid-myocardial cells have a slightly prolonged action potential, but nothing to write home about. Usually about 40 millisecond differences in action potential duration across the transmural wall. And so this is pretty much what, you know, would have been predicted from Yoram's simulation under conditions of normal intercellular coupling. And, you know, there are differences, but not major differences. And by the same token, that's probably why you can't induce arrhythmias with a single extra stimulus. Now, you make your model of long QT syndrome by giving an IKR blocker, and things change quite dramatically. You prolong action potential everywhere, but there seems to be a selectively prolongation of the action potential in mid-myocardial cells compared to other cells. And this selectivity comes, as I mentioned before, from the sensitivity of these cells to IKR blockade, because they're relying on IKR for repolarization more so than other cells. So when you put this all together, and if we focus on the bottom panel, these are action potential maps. Repolarization maps. You look at baseline. There's some inhomogeneity. This broad area. Now this is going to get to the question of where these cells are. There's a broad area that has prolonged repolarization. But the differences in these gradients are relatively small, 30, 40 milliseconds. As you slow the heart slow the heart rate down, make bradycardia, you grow these gradients. They increase in magnitude dynamically. You give Sotalol, they increase more. And the combination of Sotalol and bradycardia produces these relatively large, dense gradients. And you could measure the gradients by the number of repolarization isochrone lines, the density of the isochrone lines. Milliseconds. Yeah, sorry, I got clipped off somehow. So you know, propagation is the same in each case, and you see the substrate, the repolarization substrates, changes quite dramatically. Repolarization is much more labile than propagation. Now, interestingly, when you look across the heart, the pattern and distribution of these cells, now the so-called mid-myocardial cells, you could think of as the orange zone here. Sometimes they form as sort of pseudo bands across the mid wall. Sometimes it's more like an island formation. Here's a couple of islands here. Here's a clear island over here. But what seems to be, now a couple things about this. One is, what is an M cell? You know, is this an M cell and that's not an M cell? We're not smart enough to tell the difference. So I think one of the things that we try to do with the mapping is we'll just show the data. We show the distribution of action potentials without trying to make any inferences with regard to how you define what an M cell is or not. But it becomes pretty clear that what we see consistently is there tend to be very most significantly marked gradients between the epicardial zone and the mid-myocardial zone, because the epicardial zone has the shortest intrinsic action potential. The mid-myocardial zone has the longest intrinsic action potential. And so this seems to be the business end, the most significant interface of inhomogeneity that develops across the surface of the heart.
These are snapshots?
These are, yeah, but if you recorded this beat after beat after beat, it would look exactly the same. This doesn't change over time. But these are different hearts. So the point here is that the actual topography of these cell types you get are variable, depending on what part of the heart you get them from. Some tend to go more toward the endocardial surface, some more towards the epicardial surface. And this creates a little bit of a headache if you're trying to model where these cells are. But importantly, regardless of where they are, when you introduce a premature stimulus, it blocks into the mid-myocardial zone, usually near the epicardial to mid-myocardial interface, and then you get an arrhythmia on the basis of reentry. And what happens is you initially have this broad region of this zone of block, which rapidly collapses because M cells have very dynamic restitution. Their exponential durations are very sensitive to rate. So this zone of block collapses into a line of block, and then you have a rotor that's spinning around the heart. And because it's a meandering rotor, it gives rise to this polymorphic appearance on the ECG. And we thought this was reasonable evidence that reentrant excitation plays an important role in the mechanism of torsade. Now, this says nothing about the initiating mechanisms. This says nothing about the role of EADs, which can be very important as triggering beats. So we don't really look at this as triggered beats versus reentry. We think there's probably a role for both, as there probably is in.
This is intramural reentry.
This is intramural reentry. Yeah, you can see even in these two beats. These are two sequential beats. They change, right? And then it goes into the preparation and we lose it.
So
we could map it for two, three beats. The arrhythmia can persist indefinitely or it could last 5 seconds, 10 seconds and self-terminate.
It
we can't map it. It leaves our. What we have observed empirically is that bigger wedges have more sustained arrhythmias, which is probably not a surprise.
Yeah.
Oh, this is top to bottom is about 14 millimeters.
In the big preparations, it degenerates. Does it stay as torsade?
It stays as torsade, but it just tends to persist more, if not indefinitely. Okay, so I want to get to heart failure because we propose that there's actually a unified hypothesis that may explain the generation of arrhythmias in long QT syndrome and in heart failure, because the patterns we see are very similar. This is another wedge preparation, but we study the wedge now after subjecting the animal to heart failure. So it's you put a ventricular pacemaker in, you pace the heart at 270 beats per minute for about 4 weeks. And the animal develops a cardiomyopathy, has clinical signs of heart failure. They get edema, they swell, they get lethargic. We monitor these things by echocardiography, which I showed you in the second slide, so you can see the progression of heart failure. And then what we do is we take the wedges out and we do optical mapping studies. And you can see a couple things. You know, when we talk about geometry, you can see there's a marked change in geometry of the wall. It's markedly thinned in the failing myocardium. Now, this changes with stages of heart failure. Early on, you get hypertrophy, the muscle actually thickens. In the later stages of heart failure, with decompensated heart failure, the muscle actually thins somewhat. So for those of you who are trying to simulate disease states and true geometries, that is another dimension of complexity you have to consider. So there's a somewhat smaller muscle mass. But what's interesting in heart failure in this model is that it's associated with significant prolongation of the QT interval, exactly what many others have shown before in their recordings without optical mapping. And if you look at these optical action potentials recorded from the epicardium, it really nicely demonstrates what has been shown before, which, first of all, that a heart failure myocyte is characterized by a prolonged action potential. Now, notice in the intact multicellular preparation, the prolongation in action potential duration of the epicardial cell is not as dramatic as in the isolated myocyte that I showed you on the first couple of slides. You also notice that the morphology of the action potential has changed. In a normal heart, you have this notch and dome characteristic of the transient outward current. Transient outward current is known to be underexpressed in heart failure, and so it's absent. We don't see notches in heart failure epicardial myocytes. So there's some electrophysiological remodeling going on. Now, of interest, when you introduce a premature stimulus, a single S2, you get more or less the same thing. You get a polymorph ventricular tachycardia. Interestingly, they tend to not be as long-lasting in heart failure wedges as they are in torsade. Maybe that's because the mass is a little smaller, I'm not sure. But they tend to be self-terminating episodes. And a little more than half the cases, with a single extra stimulus, we can induce polymorphic VT. And again, in no cases can we induce VT with a single extra stimulus in a normal heart. So it's a nice disease model, because we can discriminate normal from abnormal. Okay, so what's the underlying basis for arrhythmogenesis in this model of heart failure? I'm going to show you that. So the answer is yes, and it's a very similar story to torsade. It's very similar. What happens in heart failure is this is a normal heart. It shows you the action potential duration profile for the three cell types, mid-myocardial cells, endocardial cells, epicardial cells. You see they have their action potential rate-dependent profile that you'd pretty much expect, with the mid-myocardial cells having the longest action potential and somewhat of a more brisk action potential duration responsiveness or restitution. At baseline, you have gradients of about 50 milliseconds that are not of sufficient magnitude to cause unidirectional block or reentry. And in heart failure, the situation changes quite dramatically. In our hands, heart failure induces world record action potential gradients that we have not seen in any other experimental model that we've ever worked with. You get huge differences over very small distances. Between the epicardial and mid-myocardial zone, you get gradients of up to 100 milliseconds in magnitude. These are enormous. In most optical mapping experiments we perform, whether it's guinea pig, dog, mouse, we find very consistently that in a normal muscle, an action potential gradient, spatial gradient of 10 milliseconds per millimeter is usually required to induce unidirectional block. About 10 milliseconds per millimeter. A normal guinea pig is usually about 3 or 4 milliseconds per millimeter. A dog is about the same. These are huge gradients that are produced in this interface. And the reason the gradients are formed in heart failure in this model is because there seems to be a selective effect of heart failure on mid-myocardial cells and endocardial cells. See, the M cells, shown in red, shot up dramatically, whereas epicardial cells were affected relatively modestly in heart failure. And this, again, I think what I like about this is that it points to the importance of integrating research at multiple levels. Because if you look at the molecular work and the ion channel work done, you would say, well, ITO is the most significant current that's remodeled in heart failure. Well, the cells that have the most abundant ITO change the least in heart failure, which tells you that ITO probably isn't a major player in the heart failure electrophysiological phenotype of heart failure. Colleen?
How do you now differentiate
between
cells when ITO is
not
really expressed?
Well,
let's forget about the definition.
Yeah.
So if he shows his gradient, who cares?
Yeah, but my question is, how do you know what's an epi cell and what's an
end cell? Epi and endo are easy. It's anatomically, we scrape a cell off the epicardium, we scrape a cell off the endocardium, that's easy. The mid-myocardial, we have to take an average over a certain region to get it, and albeit a somewhat arbitrary definition, but the patterns are consistent.
So these are measured on single.
Well, this actually was measured with optical mapping in an intact heart.
The answer to the question is it just refers to position.
Yes. Yes.
So how do you know? Well, you don't know, but this is the name you're giving to the position.
Right. Well, it's fairly easy to define these. So an epicardial cell is a cell within the top 1 millimeter of the surface. An endocardial cell is a cell within the bottom 1 millimeter. It's anatomically defined. And mid-myocardial is everything in between. But you have to be careful in defining mid-myocardial cells because the topography of the cells are complex. And this is one of the problems also with a lot of the work that's been done in heart failure. You know, when people poke cells with microelectrodes or take wedges of pieces of tissue out for doing Westerns, if you don't know where you're looking, if you don't have a view of where these cells are distributed, you could easily miss and think you're getting what it looks behaves functionally like a mid-myocardial cell, and it actually isn't. behaving like a mid-myocardial cell. And so that's why we think it's very important to actually map the topography of these cell types, because they can be very complicated. And it's been very humbling for us as we've tried to do some biochemistry, which I'll try to get to. You know, when you try to go to different cell layers, it's very hard to just stick to anatomical definitions, because it really is, you know, putting a needle in a haystack. When Charlie defined the bands of M cells, you know, they did it with, they put a single microelectrode in, you know, and found there was, one region had a prolonged action potential. So it was logical that they sort of visually said, well, there must be a band of cells. If you only have one recording, you know, two points make a line. And so if you only have one, you know, one point, you know, you're going to make a line or a plane. But it's more complicated than that. Jim?
To what extent do you think coupling versus ion channel remodeling contributes to the gradient theory?
I think to a significant extent. And let me show you some data. Let me show you some data. Perfect. Let me just quickly get through the heart failure. So basically, at the end of the day in heart failure, you get these marked gradients of repolarization, particularly between the epicardial and mid-myocardial interface. There was a question about reentry, and sure enough, with a single premature stimulus, you induce block between the epicardial and mid-myocardial interface that leads to reentrant excitation, very similar to what I showed in Torsade. You get polymorphic VT, and then the thing drifts off the mapping array. So let me focus for a moment on what an area that we think is really key to all this business, and that is, if you look at the action potential gradient that you see across the heart, this is in heart failure, but you could see it in the long QT model as well. If you take the derivative of the action potential profile, it gives you an action potential duration gradient, epicardium to endocardium. And what we see very consistently is there's a discrete elevation in this gradient in the interface between the epicardium and the mid-myocardial zone. And this is where we see conduction block when we induce reentry. And so it seems that something is happening in that interface that's producing a substrate for arrhythmias, both in the case of Torsade and in heart failure. And so this was we hypothesized that changes in coupling may be important to this, as Jim just alluded to. And to address this question, one of my students, Steve Polzing, devised a really interesting system for doing structure function analysis in vivo in one of these wedges, and where we can do biochemistry and then compare it to function. The way he does this is we take multiple sections across the transmural wall that are sectioned pathologically, and then Steve used the immunofluorescent labeling of connexin 43 to ask the question of whether there were differences in distribution of connexins that could account for this. Now, This hypothesis was based on an earlier observation by Gonson Yan and Charlie Anzelovich that there seemed to be an increase in tissue resistivity between the epicardium and mid-myocardial wall. It wasn't known why there was an increase. And we hypothesized that connexin remodeling may have something to do with this. So you see the red signal corresponds to connexin. And when you look at a section from the epicardium, probably from across the wall, hopefully across the room, you can get a sense that there's less red. There's less expression of connexin 43. And if you take multiple segments and average them over each layer, you can quantify the connexin profile. So you essentially are mapping connexin 43. You can map other proteins as well, and then correlate it with the electrophysiology. So what you see is there's a significantly reduced expression of connexin 43 in this epicardial interface. Now, this was also validated against Western immunoblotting. So we took multiple segments here, did Westerns for connexin 43, and found a very nice correlation between the confocal. This is control. This is a control. Now, I could tell you, in heart failure, take all the red you see and divide it by two. Okay? It's essentially the same result. It's just you have we find a 50% reduction in it may be the particular section. There's a little separation in this section. It's not quite as good of a section, but we.
I think this is a cleft.
It could be more related to the isolation procedure. Yeah, they normally are more densely packed. But when we looked at it in more detail, the there was no qualitative difference in the distribution of connections between the.
David?
Yeah.
Are they
In heart failure, are there, is the density half because the cells are twice as big on hypertrophy, or is it?
I don't, we've looked at cell size and control. We haven't measured cell size in heart failure yet, so I don't know if there's a proportional change in relationship to cell size. My guess would be probably not, that the degree of connexin underexpression is... Right. But individual myocytes can still be hypertrophied. There's apoptosis and all kinds of cell...
But you can measure cells in individual density of gap junction
and 3D reconstruction. Yeah. Yeah, and that's, of course, the advantage to immunofluorescent measurements with confocal is that you can make those kind of qualitative assessments.
But aren't you surprised that there wasn't enhanced gradients in the heart failure?
Well, they were markedly enhanced.
No, of this red stuff.
What happens is there's reduced expression of this protein that's responsible for cell-to-cell communication in the heart that's localized to the epicardial to subepicardial layer. So in the regions where we see the steepest gradients of action potentials, you have relative uncoupling, or relative, I haven't made the case for coupling yet, but relatively reduced expression of connexin 43.
But I thought you said that the difference between the control and the heart failure was that you just divide this by two throughout.
Right.
So then the gradients don't change.
Right. But they don't need to in order to produce, to amplify action potential gradient. If you had if you have an ion channel heterogeneity across the wall of the ventricle and you uniformly reduce coupling, that will amplify the gradient of action potential duration. It doesn't have to be an inhomogeneous reduction of coupling. Okay, so what's the evidence of altered coupling across the wall of the ventricle? Now, the evidence for this in the past from Charlie's work came from a somewhat contrived estimate of resistivity by applying large extracellular fields to the muscle. And it was an estimate that suggested there were altered coupling. And I think this shows a little more directly what's going on. If you look at propagation from endocardium to epicardium, you see some crowding of isochrones. There's some slowing of conduction on the epicardial surface, which is what you would predict if you have relative uncoupling. If you look at the action potential upstrokes, as we propagate from the endocardium to the epicardium, you see a discrete separation between B and A, indicating a discrete region of conduction delay. And importantly, the conduction slowing is associated with a more rapid rate of rise of the action potential upstroke rather than a reduced rate of rise. Yes? 5 minutes, my God. Okay. Okay, so this was strongly suggestive that conduction slowing was not caused by depressed excitability, but actually by altered intracellular coupling. And you get the same thing if you pace the other direction. I don't have time, but this methodology allowed us to also measure the space constant. It's essentially an index of the space constant. It's not really the space constant, but it's derived from the simpler one-dimensional cable theory that gives us an index of the degree of coupling based on the fall off in voltage in space that occurs in response to a subthreshold stimulus that's injected anywhere in the myocardium. So we inject current in different locations and measure the fall off in voltage, and the rate of decay of this fall off is a handy measure of intracellular coupling that obviates the need for taking the myocytes out and making pairs of myocytes and injecting current between them, which is a much more complicated experiment. And at the end of the day, here's what you get. The connexin profile shows there's a significantly reduced connexin expression in the epicardial interface, and this is associated with functional changes indicative of reduced coupling. Conduction velocity is significantly less, the rise time is less, or DVDT is much more rapid, and the space constant is depressed. And boy, so Igor, how much time do I have? 5 minutes. How much time? When did I start? I don't remember. Was it that long? Boy. All right. All right, look. This is a very sophisticated audience with regard to alternates. I'm going to blow through. I just want to show you a few very recent things because a lot of this is old news. The background, anyway. I did want to point out for this group that this is a summary of the major clinical trials that have been performed with T-wave alternans to this point in time. There's about 3,000 patients about 15, 20 trials. And the one thing, just to give you some clinical perspective, what's interesting, what you see, and this is difficult to read, but I really want you to focus on this column here. The negative predictive value of T-wave alternans is very high, regardless of what study you look at and what population, upwards of 95-98%. So the bottom line is that if a patient has no detectable microvolt T-wave alternans, they have a very low likelihood of having a life-threatening arrhythmia. Dan Bloomfield at Columbia just presented at late-breaking clinical trials at the last ACC, a NIH-sponsored study that he was the PI of, where they looked at a large number of MADIT2 patients. I talked about the MADIT2 population, and they did T-wave alternans measurements in that population, and with 2 years of follow-up, had no events in those patients who tested negative, who had negative T-wave alternans tests. So I think it's quite clear that T-wave alternans is a very strong marker of susceptibility to arrhythmias. What clinical niche it ultimately will have is still remains an open question, and there's a lot of trials going on to resolve that. But I think it's encouraging for those of us who are interested in the underlying mechanisms, because I think it's worth pursuing, because there clearly may be some lessons to be learned regarding the pathophysiological mechanisms of reentry. I'm going to go through this very quickly, but in the interest of time. So, you know, we've been looking at this for some time, as many others, mainly using optical mapping techniques. And, you know, what you find basically is that the alternans that occurs on the microvolt level on the ECG is associated with much more significant alternans on the action potential. And the alternans that's observed electrocardiographically most likely arises from an event, an alternation in the repolarization phase of the action potential that occurs on the cellular level. There's something about the myocyte that's making it alternate and giving rise to this phenomenon on the ECG. As you all know, it turns out that one very important triggering event when alternans occurs is the formation of discordant alternans. The cells across the heart tend to alternate in phase. You see the yellow beat and the green beat. All the cells are shortening on the same beat, lengthening on the next beat. You reach a critical heart rate threshold where one cell could prolong its action potential, and at the very same time, despite the fact that these cells are well coupled to each other, this cell shortens its action potential, and that's called discordant alternans, and that turns out to have significant consequences in organizing repolarization. This is a panel showing marked gradients of repolarization induced during discordant alternans that's not present during concordant alternans. And this actually turns out to be a mechanism for reentry. So you can have low repolarization gradients, 4 or 5 milliseconds per millimeter. The moment you have discordant alternans, these gradients are amplified to the order of 10 milliseconds per millimeter. And now you have dynamically formed a substrate for reentrant excitation. And there's a number of questions regarding the underlying mechanism. Bob and others in the room have really spent a lot of time focusing on the importance of restitution, and I'm not going to go into that in detail. I wanted to point out a couple observations that we struggle with sometimes with regard to restitution. One of them is here. If you do a restitution plot during alternans, you get two restitution plots. So for example, these are the same cells. So here's a long, short, long, and then you put a diastolic interval of 40 milliseconds and measure the resulting exponential duration. Here's the short, long, short, and you do it after the short here, put in the very same diastolic interval, and you get a different answer. You get a different APD, depending on what phase of alternate you put it in on. And so when you construct a restitution curve, you get two restitution curves, one that may have a slope of 1 and one that may have a slope greater than 1. So it's pretty complicated business. And again, it just raises questions about trying to assign one unifying mechanism. Another thing that Etienne Prevost... this was just doing a restitution curve, but after even beats versus odd beats. No, just in concord and alternans. So it's just it's a level of complexity that I think we have to take into account in models and so on when we're looking at alternans and trying to relate it to restitution slopes. The other thing is Etienne Prevost has showed this in our group. So if you want to look at one way to look at the importance of restitution is to induce alternans in a heart that has a very well-described inhomogeneity of restitution properties across the surface of the heart and see which cells get alternans first, okay? And so in the guinea pig heart, for example, there's a consistent gradient of restitution from the base to the apex, okay? From the RV base to the apex that is very uniform and very consistent. And when you induce alternans by progressively increasing heart rate, you don't get alternans first where restitution is steepest. You get it where it's slowest, actually, or intermediate. You can find it in a zone over here. And to make a long story short, this happens to be the region that has the weakest degree of calcium reuptake when we look at the calcium transients, and the weakest expression of circa. Okay, so there's some data that suggests then that one may have to look at the sarcomere to explain the mechanism of alternans, at least as an alternative mechanism. These are data that were shown already that basically show you that when you voltage clamp the cell and stimulate, you can clearly get an alternans in the calcium transient. Allen showed that, again, suggesting that this is being generated. Doesn't prove it, but it's strongly suggested the process is being generated from cytosolic calcium alternans. And then if you do things like you give some pyruvate that relatively selectively impairs the ryanodine release channel, you can show a nice alternans by blocking one component of calcium cycling that washes out. This is from Huser's group that has done a lot of work in this. So poisoning various elements of calcium cycling seems to play an important role. If you induce alternans in the whole heart, these are from Ken Larita, my colleague, and you look at this is a case of discordant alternans from the base of the heart to the apex of the heart. This is a voltage map. This is a calcium map. The voltage alternans just follows the calcium alternans everywhere in the heart, and regardless of what patterns you see. So there's a very close relationship between the two. Now this is, I just wanted to show that this is just some amazing data that's come out in the last couple of years, looking now at a subcellular level of development of alternans. And this is now we have yet another definition of discordant alternans. If we didn't have enough already, now we have discordance across the myocyte. So you can have discordance in voltage between cells. You can have discordance in electrical and mechanical activity. And now you have a spatial discordance across a myocyte where there's a big release here, a small, big release here, small, in one region of the myocyte. And this really is a very humbling recording because, when you're looking at whole cell calcium transients, you could miss this. If you have, if the amount of calcium release is uniform everywhere, and you're just doing a whole cell calcium measurement, you could miss the alternans because it could be very local. And they could be these, I believe, were atrial, yeah. So this is, so people are now finding that if you poison the ryanodine release channel, for example, at one end of the myocyte, you can induce a very selective alternans. And let me, Igor, just try to wrap it up with just a couple more slides before he grabs the stick and hits me over the head with it. So what we believe is going on is this. And I wish I had a little more time to show you the data that supports the hypothesis, but we believe alternans is, on a cellular level, is initiated when the heart rate exceeds the capability of the cell to cycle calcium. And as you elevate heart rate, what you're actually doing is you're loading the cytoplasm with calcium. So you're taxing the system that's normally responsible for cycling calcium through the cytosol. And And whether you have an impairment of circa or an impairment of the ionic release channel, that is going to make the cell more susceptible to calcium transient alternans. And then, well, the calcium alternans won't cause T-wave alternans, right? You'd have to have a change in voltage. And so what's most likely happening is there's one or more calcium-sensitive sarcolemmal channels or pumps that are then responding to the alternating changes in calcium levels that are producing the voltage alternans. Now, the fact that we typically see a large release, calcium release, associated with a long action potential suggests but does not prove that the exchanger may be the electrogenic mechanism, because you expect the calcium, a large calcium release, to go with a prolonged action potential, whereas if the L-type calcium current was the electrogenic mechanism, you might expect it to go the other way. And that is yet to be worked out. But let me just show you. I was going to show you some stuff on memory. You know, this just shows you that if you look at the heart rate alternans profile, and by progressively reducing cytosolic calcium load with BAPTA, you can very nicely change the threshold for alternans. So inducing alternans is very, very easily titrated by the degree of cytosolic calcium load, which again points to calcium as a mechanism. And I'm not going to talk about this, but let me just show one more thing. You guys know all this stuff. This is the mechanism of alternans. I actually think for discordant alternans that I think restitution is going to be very, very helpful in helping us understand this. And it may be different. The role of restitution in the initiation of alternans on a myocyte level may actually be different than the role of restitution in promoting discordant alternans, both conduction and action potential restitution, I think, may be very important for discordant alternans. I'm not so sure it's going to help us explain the generation of alternans in a single myocyte. But let me just show you one last thing, Igor. This is just some very recent data showing that there's actually these differences in calcium transients are predictable and topographically. Xiaoping Wan and our group made these calcium recordings showing that endocardial myocytes are much more susceptible to alternans than epicardial myocytes are. See, at the same heart rate, this epicardial cell is not, this calcium transient is not alternating, where here it is alternating. And this seems to correlate very nicely with intrinsic differences in calcium handling properties across the wall of the ventricle. And I won't go into this, but most recently we're finding now that this may be explained by regional differences in expression of certain calcium handling proteins. And in this particular paradigm, endocardial cells have significantly reduced expression of ionic release channel and reduced expression of circa. So our working hypothesis is that you have regional differences in calcium handling properties, which can then be markedly altered by disease. I showed you the calcium transients in heart failure, which can significantly change the susceptibility of a cell for developing alternans. And the organization of these heterogeneities then may predispose to discordance superimposed with effects of restitution, conduction restitution, and other effects of propagation that can modulate the appearance of discordance. And I think that's where we're kind of moving at the moment. And I'll just very quickly acknowledge our collaborators. Charlie and Gonson really helped us get started with the wedge preparation, and our students who were very, very instrumental in these studies I showed you. I'll stop there. Sorry, Igor.
So I guess we're allowed to break now.
I think we had our break.
Yeah, we'll be very happy to get back. So we already are 40 minutes late with our discussion, but nevertheless, I think it's not a bad idea. We have a very short discussion, and Jim Weiss wants to show a couple of slides and how to bring all what we discuss here in this one wonderful 5-6 days to the clinical arena. And also, while he's getting ready, I would like to ask you to think about how to bring this experience, a wonderful experience, this particular conference, to something which can be sustained for years to come. Maybe we can talk about different format of the meeting, different mechanisms of funding, different locations,
But I think it's really very important to sustain this kind of activity so we can directly interact with the speaker. Very important that he also experimental studies and technical studies. More fully loaded. One thing which I think is missing here in this room is some fair number of students and junior colleagues who could also take it dynamically.
Interesting behavior.
Some fresh ideas.
So.
Yeah. Some of you already it, our conference in August, just like the first smoking conference on cardiac arrhythmia mechanisms. So there are some pluses and minuses in the arrangement of the conference.
Okay, I just want to make sure I'm
Talking about something.
So, Jim, I think they want you mic'd too, so you can record this.
Large number of very good written ad hoc support letters to the Gordon Committee, and we'll learn very soon whether or not it's approved. Another conference which I think also has to be continued, and I hope David Rosenbaum will consider continuation of the conference. It was an optical mapping conference several years ago, which resulted in a book, and this is something also I think what we should consider here down the road. There's some kind of a document as a result of this conference which would summarize what we discussed here. I'm not sure what format to choose, whether it's going to be a special issue of Journal of Cardiovascular Physiology or some article which would summarize problems.
Maybe a different journal. Soon.
Or maybe a new Journal of Cardiovascular Physiology which will be coming out soon. So these are all kinds of issues I just summarized. And please think of what we are doing and we'll discuss after 10 minutes summary Jim Weissen, clinical implications of all these ideas which we bring from physics, chemistry, engineering, and molecular physiology.
This will be quick, and I really, this is more of a format for discussion. You know, we're here in this room because for two reasons. One, this whole subject is a really interesting problem, just from an intellectual standpoint. But secondly, because it also may actually help people. And I'm going to put on my cardiologist hat now and take that approach to try to see how we can tie some of this information together as a way to think about how we might use it to really develop some effective therapy to get us beyond putting this, you know, box inside our chest which gives a large electrical shock in order to get us out of fibrillation. And you know, here's the problem. PVC initiates ventricular tachycardia which degenerates to ventricular fibrillation. And for 20 years or 25 years or so, cardiologists thought they had a good handle on this, and it's a very compellingly simple and logical hypothesis. If you prevent this, you'll prevent this. But the problem was that when we finally got around in the 1980s to doing clinical trials to really see whether drugs that were documented to suppress this in real patients after myocardial infarctions, in the CAS trial, you had to have 80% of your PVCs suppressed in order for you to be considered, you know, to accept it into the trial. And the problem was that despite a high rate of suppression of those, the patients on the drugs died more frequently than the patients who were left alone. So that's the problem, and I think that's the message for this very interdisciplinary audience here, is that something goes on in this phase. Even if you reduce this to 20% of the incidence, if you don't, if you do other things that make this more likely to trigger this process, you've essentially defeated yourself. So that's where I think understanding the dynamics of this process really becomes critical. And we've heard about a lot of different presentations. You know, I think we have wrong one. This is sudden death in Santa Barbara sometimes, the uncommon form. You know, but I think the purpose here is that we really can study best experimentally at the molecular level.
But we have all these levels of integration to get through to make sense out of what's happening up here. And I think this kind of effort where we really integrate both theoretical mathematical biology with experimental biology is really going to be the kind of roadmap for solving this kind of problem, and not only that, really any other major problem of complexity in biology. And I think we've seen both the top-to-bottom approach integrating with the bottom-to-top approach as being very powerful. So let me just go now to kind of what I think is the bottom line. As kind of the format for discussion. And this is really, I think, a summary of what we've all been talking about. It's actually a simple graph that was Alan Karma's brainchild. But what we have is a diseased heart that gets more and more heterogeneous. And David just showed you very nicely how the transmural electrophysiological heterogeneity increases. And we know that this is something that can cause a wave going through the heart to break. And if that wave breaks under the right conditions, it can start reentry going. Whether you think fibrillation is the mother rotor mechanism or the multiple wavelet mechanism, still, both of them get started by this initial wave break. So in the diseased heart, we have this increasing heterogeneity, increasing the probability that a wave will break and start fibrillation. It's still incredibly rare. Patients with heart failure have a couple PVCs a minute. Two PVCs a minute is 1 million a year. And yet they only die on a time scale of months to years, not on a time scale of minutes. So it's a very rare event. But the probability becomes high enough so that it can actually happen. So this is a hope that we can treat this and cure the heterogeneity and prevent that happening. But it's a very difficult therapeutic target. How do we reverse the electrical and structural remodeling that occurs in the diseased heart? We don't know enough about the biology of those systems to be able to do that yet. So there is another handle here, and that many in this audience have made really fundamental contributions to understanding. And that is, waves can become unstable just for dynamic reasons. And if you take, for example, completely homogeneous tissue and put a spiral wave in it with an action potential that has steep restitution, for example, it'll break up into a fibrillation-like state. So these two, in my view, are very synergistic properties. And we know the normal heart is way up here. In the normal heart, if we initiate a spiral wave or a scroll wave in any of you in this room, you will degenerate to fibrillation. That's what's called the ventricular fibrillation threshold in a human being. And the way you do it is you put a 50 to 100 times super threshold stimulus at the end of the T wave, and you will induce VF in everyone. So whether it's restitution, whether it's calcium cycling, whether it's memory, whether it's electrotonic effects, the normal heart is up here and will spontaneously generate into VF.
Wait, spontaneously?
I'm sorry. If a rotor will spontaneously generate into
right.
VF. Yeah. Now, why don't PVCs, because many of us have them, 50% of this in this room have more than 10 PVCs an hour. Why don't we have VF? Well, because those PVCs are just a little above the threshold. And when they're in the wake of a repolarizing wavefront, they do cause unidirectional conduction block. But the separation of the two tips that are formed is not wide enough to allow the reentrant pathway to come. That's why you need 50 to 100 times the threshold. So you get enough separation of the tips that they have room to reenter. But in everyone here, we take you to the electrophysiological lab. We can give you that stimulus, and we can create ventricular fibrillation. We don't get ventricular tachycardia in you. We get ventricular fibrillation. So this is a difficult therapeutic target. Perhaps this could be an easier one if we know the right tools, if we can figure out enough of this, if we can study the dynamics and understand it well enough, perhaps that's how we can try to bring us down on this curve, so that even though we're out here on this curve, you know, we're still in this blue zone. Now the supposition here, and this is, I think, another really critical issue that needs to be studied. You know, we think that if we stabilize waves enough so that a spiral wave in the heart, a heterogeneous heart, doesn't break apart, we think that just like those second and third and fourth wave breaks after the first one are more difficult to occur, we think that the same factors make it more difficult for that first wave break to occur. From a therapeutic standpoint, that's all we really care about. You know, it doesn't matter if we convert VF to monomorphic VT with a cycle length of 100 milliseconds. You're going to die anyway. But if we can use this information, and if our supposition is correct, that those subsequent wave breaks are facilitated by the same process that facilitates the first wave break, then we have a powerful therapeutic handle. So, you know, we have a lot of theoretical evidence, and we have evidence how we could potentially flatten APD restitution or modulate memory or modulate calcium cycling or modulate electrotonic effects to prevent breakup from occurring. We hope that that will also prevent, make inducibility much more difficult. That's, as a cardiologist, what I would charge you to investigate from the dynamical standpoint. You know, I asked Flavio the other day, well, are those physiological, you know, changes you're showing? I think the work he's doing is very important. But as a cardiologist, I need to know, how many of the things do I need to worry about to develop an effective therapy? You know, that's why it's very important to define which of these mechanisms are actually physiologically relevant to the real heart, and whether drugs are going to create a problem as opposed to solving a problem. So you need to let us know which ones of these you think, they're very interesting also just to know about them, but from a therapeutic standpoint, we need to know which ones are really important. And that was really the motivation for my question to you, you know, in this regard. So, you know, I think that's basically, you know, where I'd like to open the discussion here. And, you know, leave it from there. I think that's what the clinical implications are. Thank you.
And I think that's a goal of this conference.
I'm not sure.